May wisdom speak. May we follow in her paths. Amen. Sometimes they sound better in the old language. Go to the ant, thou sluggard. That is, if you're a lazy bones, watch ants at work. Some of them have passed into everyday speech. Pride cometh before a fall. Spare the rod and spoil the child, but that's not allowed anymore. A soft answer turns away wrath. If only more of us could practice the art of anger deflection. And there are some which ought to be better known. Anxiety weighs down the human heart, but a good word cheers it up. A word fitly spoken is like apples of gold in a setting of silver. Grey hair is a crown of glory. That may appeal to some of us. And given how productive it has been this year, I have a special liking for anyone who tends a fig tree will eat its fruit. That's for afterwards. Some of its instructions feel, well, a little old-fashioned, the Book of Proverbs, and it is something to be dipped into rather than read from start to finish. But among all of the sayings are some nuggets of gold. And running right through it, the praise of wisdom, which enables people to navigate the treacherous waters of life safely. Wisdom isn't presented as an abstract philosophy, but as a practical guide to the art of living well. All cultures seem to have proverbs. I found some rather good ones on the web from Africa. If you want to go fast, go alone. If you want to go far, go together. Words should be weighed, not counted. Yiddish. It's better to light a candle than curse the darkness. Chinese. That gives a new twist to the way we begin worship. A large chair does not make a king. Sudanese. Deep doubts, deep wisdom. Small doubts, small wisdom. Chinese. The heart that loves is always young. An encouragement. And this from Slovenia. Speak the truth, but leave immediately after. So I shall be leaving church very quickly this morning. We all know that too many cooks spoil the broth and that a stitch in time saves nine, but that doesn't stop us from interfering where we shouldn't or doing everything at the last minute and wishing we hadn't. Not to mention saying something and then it all goes wrong. Like the day I wanted the ground to swallow me up. This is a bit naughty. Fingers in ears, perhaps. I'd been on retreat in a monastery and we were having our final lunch, and I was a bit demob happy after all that silence and prayer. One of the other guests was a rather serious Icelandic musician. Well, it had happened that not long before, I'd met a group of Icelandic singers in a pub in Kerry. And they told me a bit of gossip about the then president of Iceland and a well-known TV personality in the UK. So I asked the Icelandic oboist, that's what he was, if he knew about the affair his president had allegedly had with this man. There was a long silence. And then he said, "She is my cousin." Look before you leap. You should have known that all Icelanders are related to each other. Well, leave behind monasteries and Irish hostelries and come back with me to another conversation when Jesus asks his disciples who people think he is. And on the face of it, it's an odd question. Everyone knows he's the carpenter's son from Nazareth. But they've been travelling with him. They've heard what he says and seen what he does, and people are talking about him. Could he be John the Baptist, back from having his head chopped off? Could he be a prophet or even Elijah, the one who in Jewish belief must return before the Messiah comes? That's what they're saying. And what about you, Jesus continues, who do you say that I am? Peter has no doubts and blurts it out, you are the Messiah. It's the right answer. Go to the top of the class, Peter. But then two very strange things happen. And whenever the Bible is strange, you really need to sit up and think. Before we do, though, it's worth noticing the place where all this happens, near Caesarea Philippi, a town founded by Philip the Tetrarch and named in honour of the Roman Emperor. Philip was one of the sons of Herod the Great and ruled over one of the four territories into which Herod's kingdom was divided after his death. Caesarea Philippi was on the Golan Heights at the foot of Mount Hermon. I was lucky enough to visit the site over 30 years ago. A spring, we've got a picture of it on the front page, a spring comes gushing out of a cave in the rock, and it's one of the sources of the River Jordan. But it was primarily a pagan healing shrine dedicated to the god Pan, and the place still bears his name, Banias. So it's a wonderfully ambivalent place for Peter's confession of faith. All the symbolism of the Jordan in the history of Israel, on the one hand, and what for Jews was a place of idolatry and pagan worship and a reminder of Roman power, on the other. But it matches the ambivalence of the text. You might think that this would be the moment when Jesus makes his identity public, but the opposite happens. Don't tell anyone, he says. The Jesus of Mark consistently hides who he is, tells those he's healed to keep it to themselves, as if they could, and now sternly commands Peter and the rest not to tell a soul. Why? The answer probably comes in what follows, because this is the moment when his teaching changes into something much darker and more disturbing as he announces to his followers not a march of victory into Jerusalem to kick out the Romans, but a future of rejection, death, and resurrection. This seems different from the Jesus of the open road, who has brought hope and new life to people ground down by sickness or despised as sinful. But if we read Mark carefully, it is the Jesus who right from the start has confronted demons, that is, the power of evil at work in human lives. In his very first miracle, Jesus casts out an unclean spirit from a man in a synagogue and it cries out, "What have you to do with us, Jesus of Nazareth? Have you come to destroy us? I know who you are, the Holy One of God, the Messiah." Isn't that extraordinary? It's Peter's confession in chapter 8, but put into the mouth of evil in chapter 1. And the evil spirit is right. Jesus has indeed come to challenge and expose the power of evil and the suffering it causes. How remarkable that evil recognizes him before any of his disciples do. And yet not so remarkable, because whenever people rise to confront it, in whatever form it takes, the fight is on. The second strange thing that happens is that Peter gets his words right, but doesn't understand what they imply. When Jesus starts talking about his forthcoming suffering and death, Peter takes him to one side and tells him off. None of that defeatist talk here. That's not what messiahs do. Jesus not only tells him off in return, but utters the famous words, "Get thee behind me, Satan." It's usual to suppose that he means Peter, but I don't think that's the case. It's Peter's words dissuading Jesus from following the difficult path he's just spoken of him that come to Jesus as a real temptation. The very temptation to choose the easy path of popularity which he had fought off in the wilderness before his ministry began, as Matthew and Luke record. And of course it's a temptation. Who in their right mind would choose crucifixion over adoring crowds and victory in a war of liberation? Jesus is speaking to himself as much as to Peter when he tells Satan to get lost. It also helps to explain why he's so anxious to keep his identity secret. He knows that if people start hailing him as the Messiah, he'll be expected to lead a revolt against Rome. Victory is very unlikely, and even if it came, a whole new set of problems would follow. How many times have we seen it? In the aftermath of the Cold War, or the Arab Spring, for example, a moment of great hope dissolving into rancor and fresh conflict as people who once faced a common enemy turn in on each other. Scholars call this reluctance of Jesus the messianic secret. But perhaps the real secret is the one Jesus knows when he speaks of his coming suffering. You don't destroy the citadels of evil by armies, because that doesn't get to the root. It'll keep on springing up. I couldn't help thinking of the old Greek myth of Cadmus, who killed a dragon guarding a spring and was told to sow its teeth. And when he did so, fierce armed men sprang up from the furrows. It's supposed to be about the origins of those consummate warriors, the Spartans. But just like Proverbs, it contains a larger truth. Jesus understands that there's only one way to deal with the evil in our midst, and it is a hard one, which only the bravest souls undertake: to confront it, even if by doing so you risk your life. We've all been moved by stories of incredible heroism and self-sacrifice in the concentration camps of the Second World War, and there are many others, like the statues of the 20th century martyrs placed above the great west door of Westminster Abbey on the back of the service sheet. Against all human expectation, because this is the work of God, love rises out of the place of death to show us that there is a power at work in the universe which is never silenced by evil. That's hard enough, but then comes the harder bit. If we are to follow him, we too must deny ourselves and take up our cross in order to follow. Once again, it's easy to hear those words and make assumptions, not like I did as a child, but all that stuff about self-denial and glorying in our misery. But suppose what we are meant to be denying is not the good things of life, but the anger and the hatred and the vengeance which so easily flare up. Some of you may have watched a two-parter on BBC Two recently about British Jews. Being Jews, of course, they disagreed and argued about a lot of things. Eight of them went to Israel, and during their visit they met all kinds of people. One of them was a Palestinian human rights activist, recognised both by the UN and the EU for his work. When he began to talk to them about Israel as an apartheid state and challenged his hearers to justify why Palestinians in the occupied territories lived under Israeli military law, unlike the rest of the country, two of them couldn't take it and walked out. They couldn't rise above their entrenched opinions. A third, however, said that he had come precisely in order to be outside his comfort zone. And he clearly was. Then they were taken to meet two men, an Israeli and a Palestinian. This Palestinian terrorist, the Israeli said, is my dearest brother. He told his story, how his daughter had been blown up in a terrorist attack in Jerusalem. Then the Palestinian, who had been imprisoned for some years for terrorist activity, told how his 10-year-old girl had been shot dead by Israeli security forces. That's some cross to bear. Yet they had found, through their common experience of loss, their common humanity. They had denied themselves the way of retribution and vengeance, and had chosen to be united in their grief rather than separated by politics. I can't help thinking, if there were more people in the world who showed such courage and such love, it would be a better place. I don't know if either of them practiced their religion, but whatever words they used when they worshipped, if they did, they had grasped the true meaning of denying themselves by rejecting the opportunity for revenge and using their shared human grief to forge a bond of friendship. No one can bring back the daughters they lost. But, to use an image from Isaiah, which I have always loved, they have brought beauty out of ashes. They have learnt through the bitterest of experiences that the cycle of violence must be broken if there is to be any hope for the human race at all. And more importantly, they have shown how it can be broken, which is, of course, the message of the cross. Amen.